rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend. Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello, you're listening to the Red Box Podcast. I'm Patrick Maguire, in for Matt Chorley all week. Today, we're talking about money in politics. Next year's election is set to be the most expensive ever. But how much is too much? We'll be discussing that just after today's columnist panel with Paul Mason and Jenny Russell.
The Columnists on Times Radio.
Yes, time to discuss today's top stories with two great minds. I'm joined by Jenny Russell. Hello, Jenny.
Good morning, Patrick.
And lovely to hear from you. And Paul Mason. Hello, Paul.
Hi, Patrick.
Great to have you both. Lots to discuss. Let's kick off with the domestic implications of one of, well, arguably the biggest story of this year, if not the next year, the next decade. Israel and Gaza. It's causing big political implications too. In my column in the Times last week, I looked at whether Keir Starmer's interview on LBC had sparked a crisis of confidence in Labour in Muslim communities up and down the country. That's what some of his shadow cabinet ministers think. It's what some Labour MPs think. Let's hear some of that interview now.
I'm very clear. Israel must have that, does have that right to defend herself. And Hamas bears responsibility.
A siege is appropriate. Cutting off power, cutting off water, Sakir?
Well, I think that Israel does have that right. It is an ongoing situation. Obviously, everything should be done within international law, but I don't want to step away from the sort of core principles that Israel has a right to defend herself.
That was Keir Starmer on LBC about 13 days ago now, in which he appeared to say Israel had the right to cut off food, water and electricity to Gaza. He since insists he was giving two overlapping answers to the questions and has said he does not believe Israel has the right to do that. But Paul, this is an interview that has already assumed a huge amount of notoriety in Labour circles. Do you think, you know, Keir Starmer does have a problem with Britain's Muslim community now?
Well, first of all, here's the saddest thing. In as we go into, I don't know what day it is, day 15, day 16 of this war, the sad thing is that international law does allow you to conduct sieges. And I think many people, if we get into an even more intense stage of this conflict, are going to be surprised by how much international law actually allows you to do. That's the first thing. I think when I heard that, I thought, you know, this was Keir's lawyer brain kicking in to a question that wasn't quite clear. He clearly interpreted it as, are sieges allowed? And sadly, they are, as long as you do not target the population and try to starve them. Now, the wider issue is this. I think Labour has been absolutely right in its overall response to this. First, to be absolutely clear that Israel has a right to defend itself and a right to go to war with Hamas, which is what it's doing. And that it must be done within international law, the laws of armed conflict. That's been the basic position. And I'm glad to see no Labour front benches coming out with lines on the two-state solution, because it's only by standing by the strategic outcome that Labour and European Social Democrats have always fought for, the two-state solution, that we're going to be able to chart a way through this. At the same time, many British Muslims, many of them who vote Labour, are rightly outraged at the way that Israel has stewarded the Al-Aqsa Mosque, or in the Batley by-election. This particular issue was something that drove disaffection with Labour, and every Labour activist up there will know about that. So the art of politics here is to have arguments, not just to sort of give blank sound bites and single words, single sentence statements, and to win arguments out there with Labour's largely pacifist sort of activist base, who, like me, have stood again and again on Palestine solidarity demonstrations. To win the argument, you have to be in the argument. And arguing with people means listening to them carefully and coming back with detailed, evidence-based explanations for what you're doing. And that's where I think Labour is right now. Some of its front bench spokespeople have been really clear and competent over the weekend doing this. But it wasn't there at the beginning, because the Labour conference was meant to be this big, you know, sort of, you know, we're ready for government. I think what it showed is that while we have a great front bench team leading on foreign policy, a lot of Labour members and activists and even some MPs are not instinctively confident when it comes to these big issues of international politics. And I think that's one lesson I'd like to see the whole party learn from this episode.
What do you think, Jenny? Do you think Keir Starmer's got his response to this one over the past few weeks right?
I think he has largely, but I think the whole response to this shows what a complete nightmare it is for anybody trying to plot a path between this that says we care about the human rights and we care about the fate of each of the populations in this divide. Keir Starmer was clearly trying to, in large part, make it absolutely obvious to everybody that Labour is no longer tarnished by the anti-Semitism cloud which hung over it over Jeremy Corbyn's tenure. So he's trying to make absolutely evident to everybody that Labour is backing Israel and that there's no way that it could ever have done anything else after the appalling massacres on the border. But on the other hand, as Paul says, it seems pretty obvious that what Starmer was responding to on air was a question about whether it's legally permissible to do what Labour does, what Israel is doing with Gaza and cutting off water and power. And that got interpreted, once it was put out on a clip on social media, as whether he approved of this. So there's a difference between describing the world and advocating for it. But in this whole very, very difficult debate, then everything that everybody says has to be so nuanced, and yet it can be immediately taken out of context and portrayed by people who are understandably have very strong views of their own and feel that their own community, whether it's the Jewish community or the Palestinian community, isn't being given enough understanding and sympathy. And when Paul says that the whole of the front bench has to learn to understand what to say on these difficult international decisions, the point is that these are incredibly complex matters, and it's a very difficult thing to ask people to suddenly plunge into the understanding of the last 100 years or 2 millennia or 3.5 millennia of what's been going on with Jews and Palestinians in the Middle East.
And Paul, you know, I think Jenny makes a good point there, which is to say, no matter how nuanced an argument Keir Starmer makes, you know, he put out another clip on this over the weekend, which expressed much more clearly the position we've been discussing. The issue in these days, and I was speaking to Labour people, the Labour leadership last week, and they noted this was a key difference from, say, the Iraq period, where there was a similarly sort of toxic domestic debate over what the Labour Party should and shouldn't be doing, is that there are, the way a lot of people consume politics now is through these bite-sized videos that bounce around WhatsApp groups, and we don't see the sort of the debate and the way they've been edited. And so, you know, you can have as nuanced a line as possible, you can cover all bases, but still people will be watching this viral LBC clip again and again and again, and judging him on solely that basis.
Yeah, and I think that that's all right. You've got to, politicians have to be able to put out clips and sound bites that reflect the line. And I think largely Labour's front bench has done that. Mm. My point is that if you look at the demonstration on Saturday, the Palestinian solidarity demonstration, I didn't go on it most. I've been on all the other ones. There are a minority of people, some of them are now being investigated and arrested, who were putting out hate speech and anti-Semitic chanting. And what we've got to do is to persuade the vast majority of people who are just worried sick about what Israel is going to do to the Palestinians of Gaza, that our solution, which is a two-state solution, which is international law, which is restraint exercised by Israel under pressure from its allies, all of that is premised on being able to say, we stand with the British Jewish community, we stand with Israel, who's been grievously attacked at this moment of extreme peril. And it's being able to do it in that order that we need to mobilise and convince our, and I don't just mean Labour activists, I mean the widely Labour voting progressive public needs to be brought to that page. And the only people who can do it are people with a pulpit, people with a platform. Me, Jenny, yourself, we can, as journalists, we can do it. But in the end, politicians just need to be out there confidently having the argument. And I think, you know, at grassroots level, they have been. And that's what's going on. We don't see that either. We don't see what happened when Keir went to Cardiff Muslim Association meeting last night. But it looks from the photographs that it was a genuine meeting, an exchange of ideas, an exchange of views. That's where we've got to be. That we can't be in the business of shutting down discussion about stuff. Of course, as a Labour Party member, I don't want to go to a meeting where some undergraduate who's read one book about the Middle East tells me that Israel has no right to exist. I do understand that I have to be able to have the argument with that person. And I think let's take the argument for a two-state solution, for solidarity with Israel, for restraint under international law, and for spacing down Iranian aggression, which is going to, I'm afraid, is the background to all this, is a socialist, a social democratic position. I'm very happy to argue it with anybody who disagrees. Let's get out there and be confident as the progressive half of Britain that we're on the right side of history here.
Well, let's see how that develops. It's certainly been causing headaches for Keir Starmer over the past week. Let's move on. In the Times today, a new zero-tolerance plan will be agreed between ministers, police and retailers to crack down on shoplifting and the organised crime gangs fueling the problem. Matt Chorley spoke to Mark Rowley about this issue just a few weeks ago.
There's not a licence to commit any sort of crime. Of course, we do prioritise crime and we spend more time investigating stabbings than we do shoplifting, but nothing's licensed.
Not a licence to commit any sort of crime. Jenny, I can't imagine you agree with that.
No, it's just complete nonsense. I mean, as we know, in effect, that's what's happened. It started with the Conservatives while they were in power under David Cameron, removing essentially the penalty for shoplifting, so that if you shoplifted anything under £200, it basically wasn't going to be treated as a serious offence, which meant that the police stopped turning up for such offences. And the fact is that now shoplifting has more than doubled in 10 years, and yet the number of people charged for shoplifting has fallen by a quarter. You've now got less than a 1 in 400 chance of ending up with a charge against you if you shoplift anything. And that's just untenable. It means that shops are under siege, from John Lewis to the corner shops. You've got organised gangs coming in, sweeping stuff off the shelves and walking out with baskets full of stuff. And nobody dares stop them. And for the police to say that, oh, we're now going to make a difference to this today and we're going to have six specialists looking at CCTV footage, that doesn't amount to rare beans.
And it's organised crime gangs that are primarily driving this, do you think, Jenny?
That's right, yes. I mean, when people say, oh, well, baby milk has been taken from the shelves or soap has been taken from the shelves and this shows that people are desperate, and it's nothing of the sort. Baby milk is being taken in large quantities because you can sell it. There's a big market for it, to sell it on Facebook or in stalls. And it's the same thing for soaps. The stuff is just being fenced. And what's mostly going on, according to all the retailers, is indeed organised shoplifting. It's not people walking and thinking, I'm really hungry, I'm going to smuggle a packet of chicken under my coat. Although that's happening too.
Paul, you're an expert on the economy. What does this tell us about the state of it?
Like Jenny, I don't think this is a phenomenon of poverty. There is poverty-driven shoplifting, And I think one would have compassion for those who are driven to it. But yeah, the kind of mass scoop, by the way, almost always with the threat of violence, which is what makes it even more important that the police do investigate. I've noticed the shops in my own area in South London, both, you know, a big food chain and the corner shops are hyping, you know, hiking up their physical security in the shop and their surveillance. None of that makes any sense if the police don't turn up. But let's look at the wider issue. We're in a period of austerity. We've had long-term cuts in police funding. It's now come back. But if we want the police to do all these things, you know, from arresting people, coming out with hate speech on a demonstration in London and surveilling Hizbut Tahrir who with their jihadi rhetoric, and at the same time dealing with some local gang who's just, like, you know, heisted a local corner shop, there's going to have to be more resources. And there's only two sources of those resources here. And with my economist hat comes on to me, borrowing, taxation, three sources, and growth. We've got no growth. We're taxed to the limit and we can't borrow. The next government is going to have to sort that before being able to sort the problem of resourcing fully fledged policing of criminal activity, such as what we all want to happen.
Yeah, Jenny, like, go on, Jenny.
Well, I think I completely agree with Patrick about that. Paul, about that. It is a matter of resources. But the basic function of the state is to keep order, whether that is at the march on Saturday or making people feel that actually life is not a free-for-all where gangs get to do what they please and there are no consequences. But I think that there are a couple of things that could be done. And the one is that we could put greater taxes on wealth rather than income. Mm. And the second one is that the fact is that the next government, whether they say it or not, is going to have to find ways to reverse the worst consequences of Brexit. Because one of the reasons, as we all know, that we're not growing is because it's now so difficult to trade with the EU. And that's one of the things that's collapsing our economy.
And Keir Starmer, Paul, has said he's not going to do either of those things, at least not to the extent that some people want him to. He's not going to impose new taxes on wealth. And he, you know, will pursue closer and better relations with the EU without necessarily doing anything like rejoining the single market or the customs union. Do you think those are pledges that we'll inevitably see broken as he reckons with economic reality?
I don't think that's the substantial issue. The substantial problem, as I've written in numerous and repeated columns, we're the columnists here, for Labour, is that it has chosen to do supply-side reform as its main way of getting growth to come back. We need growth to come back. You can't borrow your way to it. You can't tax your way to it. I think we're knowing that there's a historically high yield on government debt. Okay, that's the starting point. I think the purpose of a sort of critical Labour left, you know, a critical Starmerism, which is what I more or less am, is to say, all right, well, when Plan A doesn't quite get there, what are you going to do? If we want growth to be driven by investment in green energy, suppose the national grid just remains a big block to it. What is the state going to do? And I think that's, anticipating the next 5 to 10 years, I hope, of a Labour government, the dynamics of it are not going to be driven primarily by tax spend and borrowing. It's going to be, how do we make the supply side reform, Securenomics, Reevesonomics, how do we make that work when it runs into obstacles, which it will.
Now, last week's by-elections saw celebrity endorsements aplenty. Pop Idol winner Will Young was at Labour conference in Liverpool.
That's why I'm here today. And also, I'm here to promote Labour. You know, I think we've been let down by this government.
Yeah.
I'm posh, but I'm actually not a Tory.
And Ross Kemp also endorsed Labour at the Selby and Ainsty by-election.
The people of Selby and Ainsty have been badly let down after 13 years of the Conservatives. It's time for a change. Every vote counts. Vote Labour for a fresh start in Selby and Ainsty.
That was Ross Kemp and Will Young. Jenny, what do you make of all of this? Do celebrities ever change people's minds?
Oh, I'm sure they do. I mean, we all want trusted guides in life, don't we? And particularly if you're somebody who doesn't spend their life following the political pages of the Times, though, of course, it'd be a mistake not to do that.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Then, especially reading your column, Patrick.
Stop it.
Then why wouldn't you think there's somebody I like and I trust and they've got an opinion and they're telling me what to think about this issue? And celebrities have political opinions like all the rest of us, and it would be a great mistake to think that those who feel strongly shouldn't be allowed to come out there and give their opinions just like the rest of us. The trouble is, of course, that very often they don't particularly know what they're talking about.
Well, one difference is Paul Mason, of course. Paul, were you? Did you ever count yourself as a celebrity endorser?
No. No, there was a time when people did recognise me on the street when I was working for Newsnight, but not anymore. Look, the interesting thing listening to both Will Young and Ross Kemp there was how in the mainstream they are as celebrities. The real issue, I think the live issue in celebrity endorsement of politics is when you go to the extremes, when we're talking about internet influencers. Stella Creasy, the Labour MP for Walthamstow, made several speeches at Labour Party fringe in the fringe of Labour conference, asking people to consider what would happen if Andrew Tate got involved in British politics. Because if Andrew Tate gets involved in British politics, suddenly every 15-year-old boy who looks up to that guy has got an avatar telling them to vote for whoever they are going to be. And it could be, who knows, it's certainly not going to be Labour. It's more likely to be a far-right entity. And we're also seeing some really kind of extreme stuff on Israel-Palestine out there on Instagram and TikTok from influencers. So I think what I'd let's say to both the public and to people in politics, you at your peril ignore the grifter, the person who is putting on, you know, tens, hundreds of thousands of followers and monetizing that following through extreme ideologies. They are a lot more influential than most people in mainstream politics want to admit. And I don't think mainstream politics, left or right, has any answer to it yet.
That was Jenny Russell and Paul Mason. Remember, you can read Jenny every week in The Times. Just head to thetimes.co.uk/redbox to get yourself a subscription. Up next, we're talking money in politics with Charlie Mullins and Del Vince.
Jewelry isn't a gift you give just once. It's a way to remind your loved one of a beautiful moment every time they see it. Blue Nile can help you find the gift that says how you feel and says it beautifully, with expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com and experience the convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com to find the perfect jewelry gift for any occasion. BlueNile.com.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
You're listening to the Redbox Podcast. Now it's time for this.
The Big Thing on Times Radio.
I think most people who have dealt with me think I'm a pretty straight sort of guy, and I am.
It was done through loans. It should have been more transparent. We could all accept that.
Who paid £160,000 to have a game of tennis with you?
Yeah.
That game actually take place?
Can I just make a point about this?
And it is quite right that anybody who is a British citizen has the right to play their part in our country's politics and to donate to a political party.
It's because he is simply in the pockets of his union paymaster.
Well, those are just some of the big stories around money in politics that have come and gone over the years. From Tony Blair's donations from Bernie Eccleston to Boris Johnson's tennis matches with a Russian donor. Now, we're talking about money in politics today because when it comes to election campaign spending in Britain, it turns out the sky is not the limit. Party election spending is capped at £30,000 for each constituency contested. That's equivalent to about £19 million for both Labour and the Conservative Party, who put up a candidate in every seat. That figure has not changed, remarkably, since it was set in 2000. However, the Levelling Up Secretary Michael Gove has revealed that the government intends to raise the cap in line with inflation. Now, just to put that into context, the Bank of England estimates that £19.5 million in 2000 will be worth just over £35 million today. So voters should be prepared to be bombarded with more leaflets and social media ads than ever before, as these changes in spending limits will give parties up to £15 million more to spend on the campaign for next year's general election. And I know, having spoken to them, that the people who run the campaigns for Labour and the Tories think they can hit that cap. Now, today we're going to talk about how parties might spend that money, how it works in America, where spending is on a different scale entirely, and we're going to hear from the people who choose to give their own money to the big parties. And two of them, who you will have heard of, join me now. Dale Vince, the Labour Party donor and eco-tricity, is with us. Good morning, Dale.
Yeah, morning.
And Charlie Mullins, the British businessman, the founder of Pimlico Plumbers and a former donor to the Conservatives. Hello, Charlie.
Yeah, good morning to you. Good morning, Patrick.
Dale, let's start with you. Under our system, parties don't get much state funding. And the government party doesn't get any. So they have to look to donors like you. I mean, why do you do it? You've got lots of money. I mean, you know, you spend a lot of it on Forest Green Rovers, and so people might think you're addicted to lost causes, given that you donate to the Labour Party as well. But, you know, why do you choose to spend your money on political donations?
Look, I give money to all kinds of good causes, not just the Labour Party, not just Forest Green Rovers or Just Stop Oil, Greenpeace. I fund school breakfast clubs and food banks here in Stroud, give jobs to homeless people. I do all kinds of good things. I try to help people that are trying to do good in the world. And to come to your question, Labour always face a spending deficit between themselves and the Tories. At the last election, the Tories outspent everybody else put together. And I give them money to try and help bridge that gap.
You're also, as you say, giving money to Just Stop Oil, which the Tories banged on about again and again and again. It was a bit awkward for Keir Starmer when he was trying to distance himself from Just Stop Oil. Is that why you stopped donating, to give Keir Starmer an easier ride?
No, I'm not sure if you saw my statement, but the point I made was that the Conservatives had been clear that no amount of protesting would stop them drilling in the North Sea. In fact, they doubled and trebled down, threatening to issue hundreds of new licenses instead of just a handful because of the protest. And they tried to weaponize the protest, creating a new culture war front for themselves against green stuff. And it seemed very clear to me that we can't stop oil through protest, but we can stop it through the ballot box. That was the logic I laid out in my statement.
And what do you get? What's in it for you as a donor beyond donating to good causes, as you put them, causes you see as worthy? Do you speak to Keir regularly? Do you get time with shadow cabinet ministers? Is there an advantage for eco-tricity in you doing all of this?
No, I never ask for anything. I never get offered anything. I don't want anything. I just want to help them win the election.
But do you speak to Keir?
I have spoken to him probably twice, maybe, in my life. I met him at the conference, an after-speech get-together, and we spoke for probably 5 minutes. We talked about football.
Is he Forest Green now his second team after all the money you've given him?
I've no idea, but we are going to have a five-a-side game. Well, we talk about it anyway, whether it'll happen or not, I don't know. But, you know, it's a bit of football banter between us, that's it. But look, I know how the stereotype goes, and I think it's been created through donations to the Tory party, where a lot of cash is given for influence, for policy changes, for planning consents, all kinds of stuff. And a lot of it is hidden as well. It's just not transparent. I sit in front of a camera anytime and talk about what I've given and why I give it. And it's very rare for you to be able to find, I think, a Tory donor to do the same. You've got Charlie today. I see that. And I was wondering, who you would have.
Well, Charlie has always been very open about the cash he spent on donating to the Tory party. But Charlie, you're not in that game anymore, are you?
No, I've stopped donating to him since we left the EU. And, you know, I'm rather like as Dalton. I put my money to other causes, and one of them is like Shooting Star Austria. So any money that I would have given to the Tories in the past, now it goes to Shooting Star Auschwitz. And I don't think there's nothing wrong with people donating and then raising the limit, I think, by 80%. There's nothing wrong with that, because I think, you know, everybody's got to go in there with the best chance they can. But I feel this year that, you know, hopefully they do raise it and, you know, still stay into power, because you know, they're obviously struggling at the moment.
When you were donating to the Tories, you got a lot of access. You know, you've spoken about going in and out of Number 10, meeting David Cameron, meeting George Osborne, you know, going to the balls the Tories hold for their donors. Do you miss all of that?
I don't think so. I mean, I think because I'm involved with a lot more charity work now, so I don't miss it. But, you know, it's just part of, if you put a few quid in, then they invite you. But, you know, it doesn't necessarily give you any favours other than, you know, invitations to certain things. I've met a few of the prime ministers and, you know, it's all very open and my donations are very open. But once I stopped donating, they felt that, you know, maybe they don't want to be part of or me part of them. But so the answer is I don't miss it. You know, I'm more concerned that, you know, they do win the next general election. I think it's somewhere just before a year in January. And I think they've got to chuck everything at the moment, including the kitchen sink.
Well, you can sort that out for them. As a businessman, Charlie, what do you think of Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves?
Well, they're not business orientated, so that's one of the reasons that you know, I don't want them in. I just don't think they've got what is needed. I don't think they're honest enough, and but more so, you know, Labour is just not business orientated, and that's where the Conservatives should win hands down. And you'd like to think that they could win without having to spend extra money, but you know, so much damage has been done, I think, with Partygate and the COVID situation. I think they're really struggling at the moment.
Would you ever think of donating money to the Tories again, or are you done with that?
It really depends, you know what I mean? It depends who's Prime Minister, I think, and, you know, it really depends on the situation at the time. But, you know, I was pretty put out when we left the EU and pretty put out with some other things. And so, you know, I'll probably cross that bridge when I get to it.
Is there anything you could that could stop you from donating to Labour, Dale?
I had the question. I have no idea, actually. I hadn't given that a lot of thought. I mean, I just think the Tories have done incredible damage to our economy in the last 13 years. I was listening to Charlie there saying that, you know, effectively they're more businesslike than Labour. I don't think that's true. I think they've shown themselves to be very unbusinesslike in the last 13 years. And I think we need to give Labour a chance.
What do you say to that, Charlie?
Just wait 1 second. Okay. I was talking to you. I think I only heard half of it. You disagree that Labour are not business-orientated, Dale, yeah?
Yeah, that's right, Charlie, yeah, absolutely. And I think the Tories have shown themselves to be detached from business and business interests. I mean, Brexit is a great example of it. I mean, they refused to listen to businesses that were saying this will be harmful. I mean, Boris Johnson said F business. That was like how important he thought business was. And I think that, you know, Labour, we need to give them a chance.
I'm going to probably disagree because I'm, you know, strongly a Conservative. But, you know, I think it's been a tough few years and obviously the economy suffered with various things. And yes, I think Brexit is a big disaster. But, you know, I feel we'd be worse off with Labour in from a business point of view and many other point of views. You know, but as you say, nobody knows. But, you know, can we risk giving Labour a chance? I mean, you know, the business that I know about them is just not business orientated at all. It's just giving money to people that don't work, for argument's sake. And you know, they're just not on the same level of the Conservatives from a business point of view. But, you know, it's been a tough few years, as you know, Dale.
Yeah, I do. And listen, I just think, and no offence, but that's a lazy stereotype to say that Labour just want to give money to, you know, people without jobs and people that don't want to work. That's not what it's about. And that's not a measure of how business-like Labour are. If you look at their plan for the economy, the green economy in particular, where the big opportunities are, they get it, whereas the Tories have turned their backs on it. And I think that's a disaster for our country. It's like another Brexit in the making for us, because the big economies of the world, China, the EU and the US, are running hell for leather towards the green economy because they see the benefits from it. We're turning our backs on it.
Yeah, well, again, it depends, I think, you know, who's going to be prime minister and we can obviously change things. But, you know, I'm just sort of saying nothing impresses me about Labour, nothing at all. I'd be quite frightened if they was running the country at the moment because I just don't think they've got nothing there. And the Kerr fella, I mean, you know, I just don't reckon him at all. But, you know, it's just my opinion from a business point of view. I think we'd be worse off if Labour get in.
Well, we'll see how the campaign goes. We'll see what the parties spend their 35 million quid on. Just to conclude our discussion, Dale, you know, you have donated lots of money to the Labour Party, but do you think a healthier system that would, you know, liberate the big parties, the political system, from the influence of donors, without casting aspersions on either of you, would be if we spent taxpayers' money on it? You know, in a lot of countries, political parties are funded by the state. You know, in our nearest neighbour, yeah, Ireland, that's the case. Across much of Europe, that's the case. Do you think that would be a better system?
Yeah, I do, because you mentioned the US system earlier on, and you mentioned how it's another level compared to what we've been used to spending here. And there's always been a funding gap between the Conservatives and Labour. There's always the danger of influence. Big money goes into one party or the other. There's always the danger of influence. The public see that. That creates cynicism around politics as well. And I think for a relatively small sum of money, we could have an evenly funded, fair, clean political system. I mean, selling HS2 land last week or the week before by Rishi Sunak, that costs us 100 million quid. We don't need that much money to fund a clean election, right? We could do it with 50 million quid or something like that. And I say that would be a good investment for our country and our democracy.
Do you agree, Charlie? State funding of political parties, yes or no?
Well, definitely no. I mean, taxpayers' money, I mean, we need to spend that on better things. You know, under no circumstances can it be taxpayers' money. I know it makes it more of a level playing field in the sense that, you know, a lot of the Conservatives are big billionaires that are donating, but, you know, definitely not this on that taxpayers should be paying it for the funding of that. Definitely not.
Well, Charlie Mullins, British businessman, founder of Pimlico Plumbers, former Tory party donor, and Dale Vince, Labour donor and founder of Ecotricity. Thanks very much for joining us. And let's turn our attention to the US, where large amounts of money, and that's putting it lightly, dominate political and presidential campaigns to a degree not seen in decades. Now, I spoke to Sarah Baxter, director of the Marie Colvin Centre for International Reporting and former Sunday Times legend, to find out how election spending differs in America from the UK.
It's such a shoestring. Recently, a senator for New Jersey, Bob Menendez, was arrested after his home was searched, and the police found $500,000 in cash stuffed into his jacket pocket and 13 gold bars. So that's how much money can sometimes be sloshing around US politics.
Wow. So talk us through how that happens, because here we have quite stringent campaign spending limits, quite a low cap. Michael Gove, who is the minister in charge of elections, is hiking them to just over £30 million. But compared to the amount of money PACs and super PACs, political action committees and super political action committees, can raise for candidates for, even as you say, not even presidential office in America, it's a pretty small beer, isn't it?
It's peanuts. Obviously, the example I cited was an example of alleged corruption, but the money is just stupendous in American politics. Now, if you believe the official figures, they're not so different. So, for example, an individual can only contribute $3,300 to, say, you know, Donald Trump or Joe Biden's presidential campaign. But you mentioned something called the super PACs, and they can contribute unlimited sums. They have to disclose what they are contributing. But there's also something called dark money in US politics, where undisclosed funds can flow into those super PACs, which then go up to help individual candidates, both for sort of midterm elections and for presidential elections. And there's a sort of fig leaf that means that the super PACs are not allowed to cooperate directly with individual campaigns, but they bombard the airwaves with their candidate's message. So it amounts to the same thing. And by the way, I think you'll probably want to know that the total expenditure in 2020, the last time there was a presidential election in the US, nearly $7 billion was spent, and most of it came through super PACs.
Wow. And who wins in the fundraising stakes? Is it as simple as, you know, the Republicans, there's lots of rich Republicans out there, or is it, does it vary from election to election?
Well, it varies. I mean, Barack Obama was a stupendous fundraiser in his day and got a lot of money from small donors. But so, by the way, does Donald Trump, who has been on an incessant fundraising whirl from the day he left office. And I think I think he's already raised about half of $500 million just since 2020. But of course, a lot of that has been gobbled up on his legal funds. But he is the big cheese in the room. He's supposed to have raised $7 million just on the back of his mugshot, if you remember the infamous shot of him appearing in a courtroom. So we're talking staggering sums. I think Joe Biden has so far officially raised very small beer compared to Donald Trump. But of course, as president, he can take to the national stage when he wants, as he did recently addressing the nation over the conflict in Israel and Gaza and the need to raise money for Ukraine as well. So he has that presidential pulpit. Donald Trump is constantly fundraising. And then there are people like Ron DeSantis, you know, the sort of once was Ronda Future. He was going to beat Trump allegedly at one point and be the Republican nominee. He raised huge sums of money in the first instance, mostly from large donors. But now that he needs more and is somewhat on the back foot, they're all maxed out. So it's a very sort of weird landscape, very different to Britain.
And another key difference, you mentioned Donald Trump, is if you are a very wealthy individual in the US with political ambitions, perhaps for the highest office in the land, you can essentially buy yourself into any race. You can buy the adverts, you can hire the staff. We saw that with Trump, less successfully with Michael Bloomberg, Tom Steyer, Ross Perot, for listeners of a certain age. That's another key difference, isn't it?
Yeah, very much so. I think billionaires are always fancying their chances. Do you remember at one stage there was the sort of Mark Zuckerberg alleged presidential tour?
Yeah, when he was sort of eating chips in Iowa, yeah.
Yeah, the country, I think, let him know that they weren't that interested in listening to him. So we haven't heard so much about it. But obviously he has the Facebook money to launch a presidential campaign whenever he likes. Elon Musk, of course, bought Twitter, now called X, and it's looking more and more like his personal vehicle. For what? Ultimately, who knows? So, yes, I think billionaires always think that they can solve the world's problems. You mentioned Michael Bloomberg. He was very unhappy at the prospect of Joe Biden being the potential Democratic nominee in 2020, and he was afraid that Bernie Sanders, a very radical figure, might win the primary campaign. So he decided to jump in with all his billions and was a total belly flop.
Just to conclude, do you think American politics is just on an endless ratchet up of expense?
Well, things have got worse. Things used to be tighter before, and an act was passed in about 2010, I believe, that opened the floodgates to this super PAC money, which, you know, one day, maybe, all this will be reformed. But right now, there's so much money sloshing around that, I mean, the 2020 election was a total blowout. I mean, nobody had spent, I think the total money on US politics, if you include the Senate, you know, all the congressional races, $14 billion was spent in 2020. And my guess is that even more will be spent in 2024. It's been on an absolute tear ever since, that sort of period about 2010 when the floodgates opened.
That was Sarah Baxter, director of the Mary Colvin Center for International Reporting. She spent decades reporting on politics in the US and the UK. That was her comparison. Back home here in Britain, meanwhile, the increased spending limits raises the prospect of what could be the most expensive and dirtiest election battle in British history. We've seen the two main parties already trading highly personal blows, Labour running attack ads accusing Rishi Sunak of not believing that paedophiles should go to prison, and Rishi Sunak accusing Labour of being in cahoots with criminal gangs in the perpetuation of illegal migration. Well, joining me now is Steve Parker, previously head of strategy at M&C Saatchi, the advertising agency most closely associated with Conservative political campaigns in the UK. He joins me now. Hi, Steve.
Hey, how you doing, Patrick?
Great to have you, Steve. Great to hear from you as ever. Look, we just heard from Sarah Baxter about the US. It's a really different story in the UK, even as the campaign limit increases, because unlike in many other countries, the US, Canada, political parties can't buy ads on telly.
No, you can't buy ads on TV. We have, I guess, the old party political broadcasts, which I imagine had a huge reach once upon a time, but now sort of find themselves tucked away in the scheduling. So no TV advertising means you can't get that huge reach. But you can spend on posters, you can spend on digital advertising. And the latter, I think, in particular, has where most of the budget is funneled today, I think, with increasing effect.
And this is where, you know, the Labour strategy you've just been talking about, the pretty well-honed Tory strategy that was so successful the last election comes into play. You know, do you think, given that the parties will have an extra nearly 20 million to play with, a lot of that, as well as on staffing and direct mail, will go on, as you say, social media clips, those viral clips that really do much of the running in campaigns now?
Yeah, I think we highly localised. That's how people are using Facebook. It's 650 sort of mini campaigns that allows them to run sort of every election. And you know, historically, there was a big sort of divide, national to local. You know, as a candidate, you can still only spend, I believe, £8,700 in your constituency in the month leading up to the election. But that's completely sort of taken out by digital. So it means Labour can spend national money supporting new Les in Uxbridge, and Tories can do the reverse. So it allows you to be very, very local, and I wouldn't be surprised if that's how it continues.
And how much of a game changer do you think an additional 20 million quid is? Do you think it'll make the campaign noticeably more intense, noticeably dirtier, noticeably more bitter? You know, will we see, you know, will it be properly transformative, is what I'm asking, or, you know, will it feel much the same?
Yes, it depends how they're going to spend the money. I mean, historically, the Conservatives have spent a lot of money on research groups. I wouldn't be surprised if that goes the same way. I think in 2015, when we worked on the campaign, they spent £4 million with Crosby Textor, Linton Crosby's business, and very little to MSC's actually, very pennies, in fact, at the time, really. Like, most advertising agencies did it for the fame, you know, the fees were there. And you know, you get some money, and late, you know, but the ads are mostly don't run in national media. Media is very expensive. I'd be very surprised, knowing what I've known from speaking to politicians, if they decide the way to go is on poster advertising. What, those tend to be big PR moments. They might have a bit of a reveal. This is our big ad. You know, someone in front of it, and the press called up. But then backing that with £1 million worth of spend around the country, I'd be surprised if they went back to that strategy.
On the billboards that, as you say, have become really famous over the years, precisely because of the photo calls you mentioned. Really interesting too that you say advertising agencies often do these things. Is it essentially a way to advertise themselves? You know, they'll become known to big corporates as, oh, you're the company that did, I don't know, I know this was the earlier iteration of the Saatchis, but Labour isn't working, for instance. That's what they're trying to do.
Yeah, and it's trying to make one of those ads. It's, you know, a chance to be famous. And I think for the agency owners, a chance to sort of influence politics and influence society beyond, you know, I guess, selling toothpaste and selling cars, which they might be doing for the rest of the year. So it's the chance to sort of do something with a bit more gravitas and weight behind it. But media agencies don't do these things for free. You can't go and buy posters because you want to sort of get in with the political party. Those things cost pounds and pence. And I think, you know, politicians, like a lot of marketeers, see the value in Facebook, in Instagram, in Twitter, potentially, maybe less so these days, and thus invest their money there where they can see a real difference. And also, these things are great for participation. You know, you see where you spend more money, you get more people into the ballot box. Now, the messages that drive them to the ballot box might be negative, but it does increase participation. And I think in certain constituencies, that will really help. Really help Labour, and really help the Conservatives as well. So I'd be, you know, I think they'll double down on their current strategy rather than diversify and try something new.
Interesting, and not least because, as you say, you mentioned focus groups earlier. I imagine both Labour and the Tories will be spending this money on people to run campaigns in local constituencies, get the vote out, because often that makes all the difference, knocking on doors, making sure people do get to the polls and the parties get their vote out. So it could be, as you say, Steve Parker, really transformative. Thanks very much for joining us on today's Big Thing. That was Steve Parker, previously head of strategy at M&C Saatchi, with some really interesting reflections on how that extra 19 million quid or so will transform, or perhaps not, at the next general election campaign. That's all we got time for on today's Redbox podcast. I'll be back tomorrow. In the meantime, don't forget to like, share, subscribe and follow wherever you get your podcasts from.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt, so throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.